The Breakfast Club.
Hello, Whitey.
It's a jam-packed show.
That's right.
I don't know how we're going to fit it all in.
We'll find a way. Wednesday's often that sort of day.
I like the Wednesday.
Wednesday's
like,
busy.
It is busy, but different sports and all that sort of thing. I do like it, I must confess.
It's a good day.
Yes.
Always a good day.
I tell you what, I got a little bit surprised this morning when I got into the car. Because,
what happened?
There was ice on the windscreen.
Right. I didn't have ice. I had condensation.
Yeah, no, I had to chip away at the windscreen, which surprised me. And on the, rather than the millage gauge, on the climate gauge, it was 2 degrees. So that's because it caught me off guard a little bit getting into the car.
2 degrees?
Mm.
It was 6 in my part of the woods. Right. So, but you are rural and regional, so it does often get a bit cooler in those parts of the states.
And as I was driving into work this morning,
yes,
as you know, there's not a lot of cars on the road due to obvious reasons, and multiple reasons, I saw a taxi that was a white, brand new Mercedes. Have you seen that before?
Well, these days, the cabs, taxis are anything. Because it's not
well, we know
old...
that from an Uber situation, but I didn't think from a taxi situation.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
You don't never have to seen that before.
The yellow Ford anymore. That's gone. Those days are gone. Make your own car and bring your own car and put the little thing on top and you're a taxi.
It just looked odd.
Well, it's about people. They want a bit of luxury these days. They want that sort of stuff. They don't want the yellow Ford anymore.
No.
With the LPG cylinder.
Yeah,
in the back.
That's right.
They don't want that.
That's right.
They want a little bit of European luxury as they take their trip from A to B.
Occasionally you do see the old yellow taxi that is no longer a taxi. That is a civilian vehicle. And you think, oh, gee, I'm not sure I could be doing that.
That would have been a taxi.
Might prefer to ride a bike than have to drive one of those ones.
Drive the car that you can get. But, yeah, no, there's been, I've seen Jeeps, taxi Jeeps, BMWs. Yeah, there's lots of different taxis going around these days. And the official taxi sort of dome on top.
Are you a taxi man or an Uberman?
Whatever's closest.
So you don't have a...
If I'm getting a lift from home these days somewhere, I'll Uber.
Right.
I don't know why.
Yeah, I was going to ask you why.
But I just do, yeah. I don't know. Well, throw it out there, 0416905052. Well, the problem I had for years was that the taxis would never be there on time.
Mm.
And that would annoy the hell out of me. Now, the Ubers have some moments too, don't get me wrong. But, I just do it. I don't know why. You'd be a taximan.
No, never. I drive. You know that. I don't like other people driving me anywhere. I like to drive. So that's what I do.
Well, you don't need to taxi, I suppose.
No, but I drive. I drive my car in my own vehicle, and that's fine. There's a bit that happened in the world of football yesterday.
What happened yesterday?
Well, probably last night in a way was... Trent Cotchin giving up the captaincy. And the obvious question is, who would replace Trent Cotchin as captain of Richmond? Because we're talking yesterday, because straight away it came to mind with the quick conversation we had yesterday about in the Australian Test cricket team, there is always that obvious replacement. That's not the case at the moment, but for many, many years, there was always the heir apparent that was sitting there in the slip cord and ready to go.
Yes.
And often when you think of premiership teams in Australian football, or AFL, there is that obvious candidate coming out of a successful team or a successful era. That emerged not to be the case with Hawthorn when all the stars kind of retired at the same time of that generation, that it was left to Ben Stratton, which was seen as a real surprise at the time, and then on to Ben McAvoy. Richmond might be in a very similar situation.
Well, he is standing down, as you rightly say, 188 games as captain from 2013 to 21, the club's longest-serving captain, their only triple premiership captain, of course, in 17-19-20, 7 finals campaigns, equal most in club history, AFLPA best captain in 2018, and the Jack Dye medal amongst all that responsibility in 2014. He first captained in round 4, 2010, and when Chris Newman was injured, and he also won the award in 2011 and 2012, as well as for the best and fairest. He's been an outstanding leader for that footy club, but I think it's a really good call.
I do as well.
I think it's a really mature, responsible, and aware call for Trent Koch. And I don't know who led the conversation. Clearly, don't know who led the conversation or how it came to be. But if I just think it's the right time.
Yeah, I agree.
Trent Koch to stand down.
Yep, I agree. And as I said, I don't think there's necessarily an obvious person that would, would be an odds-on favourite to get the position. Jack Graham is probably the one that sort of stands out to me if they were to go, you know, that next generation down, because Jack Revolt, I think he's only got one more year left. So I reckon they will go that next generation down. And then you start to think, well, is Joel Selwood in a very similar situation to Trent Cotchin. That it's probably, that conversation's going to happen as well. And Joel Selwood's one of the most celebrated AFL captains in Australian football history. But would they do the same thing there, that Joel is going to play on next year, but do they sort of hand it down to the next generation at the Cats?
Just doing through the numbers here. Is Dan Prestia a candidate?
I think he would be. Yep.
He's 28. He's got enough left in him. He's okay. Because you might need, do you go the 8-year captain or do you go the bridging captain?
Well, this is the thing.
This is the question that they'll have to. Flostone, he could probably do it.
Yeah. Grimes could probably do it. Yep.
All those defenders who are superstars.
Dustin Martin.
Would Dusty want to do it?
I don't think he would.
I don't think Dusty would want
to. I don't think he needs to do it.
The responsibility of captaincy and the leadership and all that comes with that. Because there is another layer to your career when you are captain. All the things that you are responsible for.
Major commitments.
From a club perspective.
I'm going with Jack Graham. That would be my choice without putting a lot of time into it. There's a text message that has come in suggesting Jack Graham. And then there's another one from Luke suggesting Dustin Martin. But, yeah.
I'm going with Dan Prestia.
Because I kind of feel, now you've been in an AFL club, so I kind of feel that captains in AFL football are a bit overrated. But.
Well.
But.
Then you look at the grand finalists.
Exactly. But what I was going to say is that when it came to Trent Cotchin, it was like, he was a bit of a leader of cultural change at that football club.
Well, that was my next conversation.
Yeah, and if you go back to Geelong, Tom Harley, I reckon, was a real leader of cultural change at Geelong.
Vandenberg
at Hawthorn is another very good example for that.
Maxwell?
So, yes, he's another good one. So, you know, you initially think in football, what do? They lead them out through the banner first and toss the coin. And it's their leaders that naturally just go about their work. But I do think that we're finding more and more examples of leaders that have forced cultural change within a football club for the better.
Well, he was the one that's, for me, he's the poster boy for what Richmond has become.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And because it wasn't about him being a superstar and getting 35 every week. It was about him doing the job that his team needed him to do every week. He happened to be a very good player throughout that time, just by the way. But he sacrificed the individual glory, so to speak, the big midfield numbers and having to be the guy, to do the job so that the guys around him would be better and they would be a better team on the back of it. He is the poster boy for that, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree with that.
The last 10 years or 5 years, whatever it is, 8 years. So I have nothing but admiration and respect for Trent Cotchin and the way he's carried himself and the way he's built that culture, or helped build that culture at the Richmond Footy Club. Jack Rewalt was talking about it last night on AFL 360 on Trent Cotchin. Let's have a listen to Jack.
It's a long time as captain, and can be credited with the shift of the whole football club, along with the coach Damien Hardwick, arguably maybe the greatest captain of Richmond of all time, probably just behind Captain Blood, Jack Dyer, and just did everything right, and we don't lose him as a player. He's going to play on next year, obviously, which is super exciting. But I mean, the door opens for someone else to come in and fill what is really big shoes. But the timing, I think, is great for the fact that there's a few of the older crew who are going to be around for maybe 1, 2, 3 more years that can help the next person through. So it's not going to be sort of thrown to the wolves a little bit. And I mean, we've got a litany of blokes that could come in and pick up that role. And just excited to see who the boys think the next captain's going to be.
There you go. Bit of Jack for you from 360 last night on Trent Cotchin. He was similar. Similar lines to what we were saying about leading the cultural change at the Tigers.
Well, they were a fractured playing group. And that often happens when you're not successful. Or correct. And Richmond had that horrendous year. And, you know, they put it all on the table and they found a way, and it proved to be a very successful way. So clearly, you know, Jack mentioned then Damien Hardwick, but from a playing group perspective, he was able to do that. And you made the call then about sacrificing his own game to not just be the one that racks up the 30 disposals, but sort of like, I'm going to lead in a very team-orientated, selfless way on the field as well as off the field, and others kind of followed, where Richmond became, rather than the team that had quite a few star players that did their thing, they became a very much a role-player-based football team. And, you know, Jack Riewoldt's a perfect example of that. He was always judged on goals, and then all of a sudden he was judged on the fact of how many sacrificial acts did he have, or direct assists, or, you know, that sort of thing. And he became known for that through Richmond's very successful period. I'm not saying Richmond's successful period is over, by the way, but, you know,
well, they're clearly going not back playing to the finals. Top of the mountain, three out of four next time. Next couple of years. Be a bit more of a challenge than that, perhaps, for the Mighty Tigers, because they might lose some young players too, as it turns out. I'm on Prestia. The more I think about it, the more it's down Prestia. Or Dylan Grimes.
Yeah, I'm Grimes or Graham.
I'm Grimes or Prestia. There we go.
The AFL Grand Final next Saturday night at Optus Stadium in Perth. If you're going to play a Grand Final in Perth, you might as well win a Grand Final, and you might as well get a Norm Smith medal. One man who's won a Grand Final, won a Premiership, and a Norm Smith medal, if you don't mind, in 2006 for the West Coast Eagles, who will be presenting the medal on the night, is Andrew Embley from the Eagles, who joins us. Embers, welcome.
G'day, Half. Whitey, how are you?
Mate, we are terrific. This is a very exciting thing. Nice to be involved, I imagine, in the first Grand Final in Perth.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we're very fortunate to get the Grand Final over here in Perth this year. We certainly understand what's going on around the country at the moment, especially what you guys are going through. So we're certainly thinking of you, and we're, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get a Grand Final in Perth. We've got such a great stadium, and we saw the Dreamtime game early in the year and how good that spectacle was. And obviously, you would have seen the prelim on the weekend as well. So, yeah, it's going to be a terrific day in a couple of weeks' time, a great night Grand Final, and to be a part of that GF in a really small way is something that I'm really looking forward to.
Well, you're going to be a pretty important man on the night, but we'll get to that shortly. Does it take you back to 2006, 15 years ago, since that fateful day for the West Coast Eagles and for you?
Yeah, listen, that was a great day for the footy club and something that I'm obviously very proud of. You don't really sort of think about it too much anymore. It's obviously when you're talking to, you know, you guys and doing a couple of sportsman's nights around this time of the year, people are always sort of asking around your experiences of Grand Final. And yeah, we're really, you know, we're lucky in 2006. The Swans were coming so hard. Probably on the flip side of that, in 2005, we felt like if the game had gone for another few minutes, then we would have been able to maybe get over the Swans. So two great Grand Finals, decided less than a kick, and it was probably fitting that both sides were able to win one premiership each.
It's a weird one, Andrew, in the sense that you played in two consecutive Grand Finals that went right down to the wire. But I think because of the Leo Barry mark, that Grand Final is remembered more than the other one. And that's no disrespect to what West Coast did, but I think that's the moment. But people forget that, I mean, you won the next Grand Final, but it was only 1 point. What's your memories of it, and particularly those closing stages?
Yeah, it was really tough and tight. But when you're in a situation like that, the thought of winning and losing really doesn't enter your mind, because if you start drifting, you're just not focusing on the next contest. So I just remember it being a really intense last quarter, and you just knew that when there was your moment or your time to go, you just had to just compete and impact and do what you could for the side. So it was just a really mentally draining last quarter, and I remember having a headache after the game for hours and hours. It was quite overwhelming, but quite surreal as well. Just because you make a Grand Final 1 year doesn't give you any right to be back there the following year. So we did it quite tough. We were challenged throughout the year. We went at our best, but we found a way, and to be able to experience that, not just for the players that play, but there's so many people associated with that victory, and you know, from the boot starter to the CEO. So it was a really proud day for our footy club.
And you had that amazing rivalry with Sydney. It wasn't just the two grand finals. There were qualifying finals. There were home and away matches. It was like you two just went to war against each other. They were exhausting watching, let alone playing.
Yeah, so in 2005, I don't know if you remember, but the qualifying final, we beat Swans by 4 points, and then a few weeks later, they beat us in the grand final by 4 points. And then fast forward a year later, 2006 qualifying final, they beat us by a point at Subi, and then a few weeks later, we go and beat them by a point at the MCG. Like, just incredible games, how the scores were, and it was just so tight. We had so much respect for the Swans. They were such a hard team to play against, but you always knew that regardless of the score, the game was going to be tight and there was going to be a flip of the coin at the end. So we're really lucky in 2006 that it went our way. Of course, yeah, that incredible mark by Leo Barry in 2005 got Swans an incredible grand final victory.
I must confess, I've always wanted to ask you this question because you got to play with Daniel Kerr, Ben Cousins and Chris Judd in the midfield. Incredible. And there was others as well, Fletcher, Braun, etc. But what was it like when you had those other players around you in that midfield, the confidence that they gave you for you to be able to do what you did?
Yeah, they just made you better. They, when you get a midfield that's so deep and you've got so many guys in there, it was really hard to, it was probably hard for the opposition to be able to stop because we had a dominant ruckman who turned himself into a midfielder once the ball hit the ground in Dean Cox. And then, as you said, Judd, Cousins, Kerr on ball. And then you had like a guy like Tyson Stengline who was nullifying the best opposition mid. And, you know, you got Braun and Embley out in the wing. You mentioned Chad Fletcher. So you just we just shared the footy around so much. And we it was good footy to play. It was, just a midfielder that just wanted to get the footy and get the game played in your forward half. And all those mids were happy to push forward at times and kick goals too. So a lot of people ask me, you know, who was the best of them all? But, geez, on their day, you know, Cousins, Judd, Kerr in particular, geez, they were unbelievable to watch and play against and play with, sorry.
Let's smile and look at Sharon McMahon because she's joined us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Smack.
Good morning. I'll make you smile, although I can't do much about the golf. There may be a bit of a pathway out on Sunday, though. Are we crossing fingers for golf on Sunday when that pathway out's been announced?
I've got a strategy. I don't hope for anything so that when anything happens, it's
just
a bonus. No hope. It's a bonus.
No hope.
Low expectations and then you get some surprises.
I must admit, okay. Smack, I'm in a similar boat these days.
Right.
I don't even bother trying to predict. I don't bother trying to pretend that I know what's going to happen. I just sit there and wait to do what I'm told.
Well, but what I know is that last weekend when we drove past a mini golf putting area, Xavier loves that, so he was looking longingly out the window, and my husband, just the look, the forlorn look on his face when we drove past the golf course connected to the driving range, it was heartbreaking.
Where was that?
Yarra Bend, actually. Oh, yeah. We drove past Yarra Bend there. We went down for a bit of a walk along the river, as you do, within the 5Ks. That's kind of what you do these days, isn't it?
Well, that's a nice place. If you're within 5Ks of Yarra Bend, that's a good place to live because that's a beautiful place.
Just sneak it in. It's very nice.
Well done, dear.
Well, once we get to 70%, we can go 10Ks.
So, well, how the world opens up. Oh, you got to laugh. You just got to laugh. Otherwise, you just sit there in the fetal position in tears. You got to laugh, Smack. You got to laugh.
Well, now that Sherelle's a very important person, that she would be getting some information from government sources.
Oh, is that right?
No, I haven't quite got my links into government just at the moment, but it is an interesting time, isn't it? I know we're speaking to Pete Hanscom later on in the show, and along with the men's side of things, of course, I'm sitting in the women's side now, and all their seasons have been thrown up in the air as well from the BBL side and the WNCL. So it continues to wreak havoc, COVID, and what we can do with sport across all levels.
So the WNCL has been pushed back to after the WBBL, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Right, okay. And when was that supposed to start?
Well, it was supposed to be starting now-ish. So there were supposed to be some games and then the WBBL was going to be played and then the rest of the WNCL season. So I think it's still a little bit up in the air in terms of exactly how that will look. But we're pretty close to hearing, I think, what's happening with the WBBL. I think the details for that are pretty close to being worked out. So that's getting very close, actually, and what's going to be happening there.
Now, what's happening with the Diamonds, Smack, as we move back to your your home ground of netball. I've been seeing on the socials a lot of players hanging out in Perth. What's going on in Perth? Because isn't the Constellation Cup series, hasn't that been cancelled or postponed?
Yeah, postponed the Constellation Cup, but there's some matches against England. So England are going to make their way over and have obviously agreed to do what needs to be done to get those games happening. So the Melbourne crew are in a quarantine situation in Perth at the moment. So that's probably what you've seen. Some of the Melbourne girls, Kate Maloney and Liz Watson, Joe Weston and Ash Braz, one of your faves half, are over there in quarantine getting ready for a couple of those matches. And everyone else, because they've been in different areas, they're not going to have to do that. But that's what that crew's doing.
Right. Okay. So that series will go ahead. That's locked in? Or is there still a little bit of speculation?
As locked in as we can be. But yes, I mean, they're definitely over there doing all that. So that is the plan, which is exciting.
Tell you what else is exciting, just while we're on that sport. Lizzie Watson, after that Achilles rupture, is back signing on for the Vixens for 2022. Not that you care, because you've jumped off, but...
I care.
But that would suggest that it's all going well for Lizzie at the moment.
Yeah, very well. So she's over in that Diamonds environment at the moment. She's not going to be playing any matches, but she's still working through that rehab process with the navicular, actually, the injury that she had. So she's recovering from that pretty well. Kate Maloney's just been announced as coming back in. So the two co-captains from this year re-signed with the Vixens. It's right in that window at the moment. The new CBA has just been agreed upon for SSN, which is actually really great news for netballers. The average pay, I think, has jumped up now from about $63 to about $77,000 for the year. So it's a pretty significant jump up for those athletes, which is really good. The base payment jumps up a little bit as well. So the new deal that Netball has signed with Foxtel and with KO has obviously put them in a really good position, which is great.
How full-time is full-time? I've always wanted to ask this question. I never have. For the Netball girls. Like, what is it? Is it 8 till 4 every day, or is it 12 till 3 on some days? How does it work?
Yeah, so it is a 12-month contract now, so that's one thing that has shifted. So they do get that significant chunk of time off. I think that's 6 or 8 weeks.
Although they do have the longest pre-season in the world, as we've worked out, Sherelle.
That is true. That is absolutely true. And so there are some restrictions. But to be honest, I don't know the detail of whether this has shifted for this new agreement, but previous to this new agreement, there was a window of time where the athletes couldn't be made to go to training. And I think that was from about 10 till 3 or 4. There was a chunk of time in the middle of the day where the athletes could either go off and work or study, because the reality is while the average is $77,000 or was $63,000, the base payment is much below that. So, I think it's a really important part of any elite athlete's life is making sure you've got that nice balance outside of what you're doing on the sporting field. So although that is true, there are some teams that have a situation where the players can train in that time, and that's fine, and that's what they do, but they can't be mandated to train during those times. But it can be, I think there's one day off they have to have a week, and that can shift and change depending on what the schedule is.
Hey, now you've been in cricket a couple of weeks, I know it's a frustrating time for you because it's hard for you to get into the office and all those sorts of things. But have you made contact with any of the Elise Perrys of this world that are Victorian cricketer and so forth? And what's that been like, if you have?
Yeah, I mean, I've been lucky that I can go into the office as part of the high performance environment. So I've been in a few times, which has been great. And yes, I've spoken both to Elise Perry and Meg Lanning, which, you know, how amazing is it in the Cricket Victoria system that we've got two of possibly the best ever cricketers we've ever had here in this country. They're away at the moment in the Aussie environment, waiting for some matches that are about to come up. So, just had a chat to them over the phone, and it's And it's really good, actually, because I think in my role, as I'm, it's becoming clearer as to exactly what impact I can have, both of those have a bit of a different slant on how things can take steps forward in that space. So it's really exciting to speak to them. And they're very, very impressive women. And I'll certainly be picking their brains a lot over my time at cricket, that's for sure.
So from a first impression perspective, as you said, we're talking about two really iconic cricketers when it comes to women's sport, really, and you're iconic yourself.
Statue.
What are those conversations like? Like, did they surprise you? Or, like, I know you've known them previously, but what's that like having, I would love to be part of that conversation.
Well, you're not allowed to be.
I know.
We can do that on air, and that's something we obviously love doing. And it is. It's amazing to have access to people like that in this sort of role. As you mentioned, I was on the board of the Melbourne Stars for eight or nine years, and so had contact with Meg Lanning when she was at the Stars then. So I've known Meg. I haven't known Elise prior to this. So. That's part of what this role is, getting to know all the athletes who sit as part of this system, and they've all got value to add in those ways. But they were both very giving with their time, I've got to say. I was on the phone with Elise for nearly three quarters of an hour chatting about things and how it could be better. So, you know, it's just the start of some of those relationships that I'm starting to build, and they'll be important ones for me because, as you say, they're iconic. And not only are they iconic, they're incredibly intelligent women. So I think that, as I said, very, very lucky to have them in the system.
Three quarters of an hour. That's a short conversation on the phone for me.
Well, yes, you do enjoy the chat. He's a good chatter, Sherelle. Yes. But he's not welcome because he's got the wrong bits for that conversation. He's got the wrong bits. He's not welcome. It's the girls' room only. Thank you. Not for you, Whitey. Thanks very much. The wrong bits. Hey, Smack, have you worked out that cricket's better than netball yet, or are you still sort of hanging on?
Well, I haven't. I did get invited to take the field on Thursday, which would be an absolute disaster for everyone involved. So I'm going to try and avoid that.
Well, you're a country girl. You would have played cricket at some stage, surely. It's netball cricket. That's what it was.
Well, no, not for girls. Not for girls. It was netball and tennis for girls when I was growing up. So I was around cricket a lot. And, you know, certainly played, you know, casually, but I've never actually played a game of cricket, which is sad. And that's part of what's exciting about what's happening in women's sport at the moment is there's just heaps more opportunities to do that if you want to. So that's great.
Backyard? No backyard action?
Oh, yeah, lots. Lots of backyard action. Yeah, yeah. Lots of all that sort of stuff, but never an official game.
Bit of chin music for at Christmas and all that sort of stuff.
Well, Johnny Mack is a bit of a legend around regional Victorian parts in his cricketing world. I think I've said this before. He played against a touring West Indian side part of a regional Victorian team and life member at cricket clubs. And so, you know, I've spent a lot of time watching and being around cricket, that's for sure. But as I said, never played it.
Well, it's about time you stepped up. It's about time you stepped up. You got the great opportunity. You probably get to go make your debut at the Junction or something. Like, it'd be something ridiculously awesome, which would be cool too. So that's your next mission for us, to get out there, and we want some vision of that.
Oh, God, what a super oval it is too. It's a great ground, the Junction Oval. It's a really nice part to go into work. When I was on the board of the Melbourne Stars, I had a nightmare. I was going to say dream, but it was a nightmare that they were short and I actually had to go out and play. It was one of the worst dreams I've had since I used to have nightmares about Halloween back when I was 10 years old.
Sort of Andrew Johns sort of areas there for Sherelle.
That's right.
The coloured clothes representing the Melbourne Stars.
Oh, it was horrible. I woke up in cold sweat, so it was terrible, terrible.
Speaking of the grand final, is a very important one down in Tasmania this weekend where the Penguin Football Club are trying to win their first flag since 1985, and this time it's under the leadership of former Sun, Saint and Tiger Mav Weller, who's been good enough to join us on the line this morning. Mav, good morning.
Good morning.
Mate, great to have you with us. This is a very exciting time down there in Penguin. I want to go back a little bit, though, because how did you find yourself captain coach of Penguin?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. Look, it wasn't something that I'd planned when I come back to Tassie. I'll come back here and ended up playing a bit of footy for my local footy club and sort of wanted that next challenge, I guess, after finishing up my AFL career. And I thought the coaching was that, and there wasn't an opportunity at my local club, Burnie, so just started the conversation with Penguin, and yeah, just it felt right, and so I've been there since, you know, October last year, and yeah, absolutely loving it there.
Well, you're doing a pretty good job, clearly leading them to a grand final. I'll ask you about your form shortly, but was there a sense of wanting to give a little bit back and bring restore some pride to Tassie footy and regional Tassie footy, because there's been a lot of talk about the demise of the local scene down there in Tassie for many, many years. Obviously, the championing at the moment is for an AFL squad, and that might change things as well. But was there an element for you that you felt you probably should give back a little bit to what you grew up with?
For sure. I mean, I felt like I had experienced and learnt a lot over my 10 years, and my story was, you know, one of sort of hardship, and I met a few different coaches and was involved in a few different clubs as well, which was important for, you know, for different views. And I always had it, you know, in the back of my head that you know, listening to a coach at AFL level, I always sort of would tick things off in my head and go, oh yeah, okay, I understand that, and I understand that that's why you're telling the players that, and so I always had a bit of a keen eye to it. But I did. I had a sense of giving back, I suppose, and an eagerness to share some of the stuff I learned, particularly a lot about the Richmond way and their culture at the end of, you know, their little dynasty that they had there. And I thought that's how you run a footy club, and that's how you enjoy your footy. So it was easy.
Maverick, I was going to ask you about that in terms of the learnings that you've had across your time, but particularly potentially at the Tigers, and how easy that is to transfer it to a different level like you're at the moment. Is it something that has a lot of synergy, or did you really have to make some changes to make it work for that more, that lower level?
We developed it organically. I think with Richmond, they have a real focus on connection between the group and relationships and developing a deeper bond with each other through, you know, different activities that they do. They have a Richmond man session that they do twice a week with a guy, and they come in there. It's basically just to get you out of your comfort zone and be vulnerable in front of the group. And, even at a lower level, I sort of have picked little things like that to try and pull the group together. And, I suppose I was gifted a little bit too, because the group is such a good group and they are very tight. So just some of those little things have just helped us strengthen that bond. And we always refer back to it during the game. And the boys have loved it as well.
Mav, I'm interested in sort of, Daniel touched on before about the state of footy in Tassie, but just even in Penguin, what would it mean to Penguin to win a premiership for the first time in 1985, and what are participation levels like, particularly from a junior perspective?
Yeah, look, so our town's about 3,000, and obviously we're on the coast. We only have six teams in this competition now after East Devonport dropped out last year, and then Smithton dropped out a couple of years ago. So, look, my opinion is that we've got too many leagues and too many teams down here for the amount of people we do. I couldn't tell you how many leagues, but there seems to be the same sort of problem with all those leagues. You know, the lesser teams or the lesser numbers, they're just slowly dropping out. And, you know, I believe the AFL has their attitude towards it is that, you know, they're not going to step in and go, nah, your team's folded, we need to push numbers back into this league or that league. But it's something that, you know, because of the history and the supporters and that sort of stuff, they're sort of just letting it letting it go. I know they're doing a bit of a reform now, but yeah, something needs to happen, I think. I think something like a bit of a model maybe with the relegation, like what's over in Melbourne. But at the moment, there's just too many footy clubs and not enough players.
We are very excited to be able to get a hold of one of the legends of Australian rules football in the week, building up to the week, building up to the grand final, if that makes any sense. And it's two teams competing that this legend played for. In fact, going through some of the numbers, it's just ridiculous. Footscray captain, 1982. Two times Charlie Sutton medalist, 78 and 80. Two times Coleman medalist, 78, 79. Five-time leading goal kicker at the Scray, 76 through 80. Melbourne's leading goal kicker in 84. Victorian representative, 78 and 1980. 177 games, 593 goals, and a Brownlow medal just to top it off, if you don't mind, in 1980. Of course, they are the statistics of the one and only Kelvin Templeton, who joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Kelvin.
Good morning, Garth.
Great to have you with us. It's a very exciting time for both of your footy clubs that you represent with such great pride. How does it sit with you that you've got two teams competing against each other for the ultimate goal?
Well, I'm just thrilled, really, that they both made the grand final after such emphatic preliminary final wins. What a great grand final it's going to be if both teams take that form into the game.
Have you found a way to lean one way or the other at the moment? I mean, you're 143 games for the Dogs, and they won their flag in 2016. But Melbourne haven't won one for a long time, Kelvin. Which way are you leaning?
Well, I think the Bulldogs have the edge, given that I played most of my career there and was club captain for a period. But it's conflicted because I have a lot of affection for Melbourne and admiration for what they've been able to do. And I'm thrilled that they've made the grand final. And I also used to barrack for the Demons before I played the AFL, and I actually can remember the 64 grand final. I was 8 years old and in a small country town listening to the game on the radio with my mother. And the tension became too great in the final quarter. I think it was probably after Ray Gavlich made that wobbling run to put the Pies 4 points in front. I raced out in the yard at that stage. I couldn't listen to it anymore, so I didn't hear the constant kick the winning goal. I remember that well. It's a long time ago, but I just hope that I just wish it was here at the MCG and we could go and watch it.
Well, I was going to ask about that, Kelvin. How often you get along to the MCG to see either the D's or get on to the to see the Doggies. What are your feelings about it not being here in Melbourne and us all being able to experience the week or two leading into that exciting game?
Well, I think it's disappointing for everyone. I mean, I think this game is building up to be such an exciting one. Two teams haven't played together in a grand final since 1954, that was before I was born, so I know it's a long time ago. And it's just a pity that we can't celebrate this at the MCG. But that's the world we're living in at the moment. And it's going to be a great game to watch. Nevertheless, they're fantastic teams, and they both play a very exciting game of football. And if they're both at their peak, it'll really be a spectacle.
Yeah, we're all hoping for that, that's for sure. And you said you may be leaning towards the Doggies because you spent a little bit more time there. I'm interested, Kelvin, in your experience as a legend of both of those teams, how connected you are to them, what they do from the perspective of past players and how much you have to do with either of those clubs?
Well, I think at the Western Bulldogs, They have quite an active past player group. Ross Abbey, who was a player at the time that I was there, does a great job in organising that. I've been to quite a number of events that they've held. As far as Melbourne goes, I've got a significant number of enduring friendships there. There's a group of us that play there that get together. Well, we haven't come together for lunch for quite a while because you can't do that sort of thing at the moment. But under normal times, we catch up around once a month for a lunch at the same place as we have been for a long time. That's been a great way of maintaining those friendships from the Melbourne days.
Kelvin, for those that don't know the story, I'd love you to share the reasons for going from the Bulldogs, where you were the captain, Brownlow medalist only a couple of years earlier, to go to Melbourne, how it all unfolded and why you made that decision?
Well, I think, I went to a pre-season function this year where the former players met the new recruits, and what stood out to me was how glowingly the new recruits spoke to the club, and the transformation since my time is quite extraordinary. To see the club so strong financially with great facilities, strong culture, and a long-term coach in Luke Beveridge. It was just a different time. The club was really struggling back then, and it was difficult to see a path out of that. But, of course, there was one. And people like David Smorgon and particularly Peter Gordon did a fantastic job later on. But it was just a real low point, and my options were certainly more promising to look elsewhere at that stage.
Was it an agonising decision? Because if this is the Footscray example, there's the Fitzroy example a little bit later on when the likes of Alistair Lynch and Gary Pert and Paul Roos almost reluctantly left the football club for similar reasons that you're talking about. What was that like for you? Was it tough?
It was very difficult. And, in a lot of ways, I wished that decision hadn't been made. But it was just a period of time. And I think the period that I was there at the club, there were a number of players, Bernie Quinlan, Barry Round, Brian Wilson, who left during the period that I was there. It's just the club now is just totally different to that. It's a club that, certainly is not going to have that issue going forward in the future. And that we're talking about, this is a long time ago, the period that I'm talking about. But no, it was very difficult. And that was what happened at the time. But the club now is, I'm just amazed at how good it is on and off the field.
I'm interested to get your take on what you think was your best season, Calvin. Was it the Brownlow year of 1980? I mean, you kicked 118 in 78. You back that up with 91 in 79. You win the Brownlow in 1980 with 75 goals and averaging about 20 disposals a game. It's a pretty big year. But just players see things differently. What was your best year in your mind?
I think it was the Brownlow year because playing at centre half forward is very different to playing at full forward.
Yeah.
It requires a full-rounded game. You can't really have a weakness. You've got to be strong at. And also, it was also a year where the team struggled. Though we finished close to the bottom of the ladder that year, so that made it all the more difficult too. It doesn't help your case at all as a key forward if. The team's struggling, and effectively the ball is in the other half of the ground more than it's in your half. So it was that made it even the more challenging and also the more satisfying. I was able to get that result at the end of the year.
How different an experience was it playing weekly at the Witten Oval or the Western Oval as it was back in those days to play at the MCG every week?
Well, it was different for a number of reasons. The Western Oval has its own intricacies. It's that wind that blows down the ground. That takes a long time to get used to as a forward because often, it means that you've only got a couple of quarters where, you've got the advantage of the wind. But the MCG was just a thrill to play on. To go there to train at just the most fantastic ground with so much atmosphere. And I remember, as most players do, playing my first game at the MCG, and that was for the Western Bulldogs, and it was just a thrill to be on that ground.
The day you kicked 15 goals, 9, 24 scoring shots, I still still can't comprehend that. What do you remember of that day? And do you look back on it and think, gee, if I kicked a bit straighter, I could have kicked 20.
Yeah, well, it was an amazing day for the team too. We broke the all-time record score, VFL score. But it was the third quarter. I'd never before or after that suffered cramp during a game. And it was the third quarter, and I cramped up numerous times. That's when I was having shots for goal, I'd run in and I'd cramp just before I kick, and that's why there's so many points. In fact, the coach bench at three-quarter time, and it happened so often, said, look, you know, if you keep cramping, you know, in the last quarter, we're going to have to take you off, you know, because so, fortunately, I didn't cramp in the last quarter.
Who was coaching?
Yeah, Don McKenzie was coaching. He was, it was just a remarkable game. And really, watch the highlights of that game. I've only seen it a couple of times. But what's notable was how dominant the players up the field were. And I mean, essentially, it was so the ball was just coming into the forward line, the players from the back line and from the centre, and were bringing the ball into the forward line so quickly. It was just impossible for Sinclair to do anything. Gary Dempsey was winning every tap out and just placing it into someone's arms and they were running in and kicking it forward. So from a forward's point of view, you couldn't get a better situation than that. And that had a lot to do with what happened.
So how many did you kick, Kelvin, when you were threatened to be taken off because you had cramp? How many did you have in the back pocket by that point?
I had seven-nine at three-quarter time, so it was eight goals straight in the last quarter.
Eight goals straight after you were threatened to take off. That is brilliant.
Fantastic. That'll stick it up you, Don McKenzie.
Oh, that's a brilliant story. Did not know that story.
So good. Yeah, Kelvin, you go on.
No, I was just saying he was in the after I'd taken the mark for the last goal, he turned up all of a sudden. He was next to me on the ground. And, he had his clipboard and he calculated that we needed this goal to, you know, break the VFL record. So he whispered that into my ear before the last.
He didn't want to take you off then, did he?
No, he didn't.
Not too many times in the world you get two legends of Bermorm on the one moment. But we've been able to do that. Sherron McMahon, of course, is our favourite. But I tell you what, coming with a rush is Cole Pearce, who took out the bronze medal in the S10 100 metre fly at Tokyo in the Paralympics. He's been good enough to join us. Cole, welcome.
G'day, guys. Thanks for having me.
Do you think you're more famous than Sherelle from Bermorm, or is she more famous still?
Well, considering what you just said, I think Sherelle's still more famous and obviously more loved, but give me a bit of time and I think I might give her a run for her money.
Well, I reckon you might be right, man. I reckon you're coming with a rush after what you've done and the way you've carried yourself through the last couple of weeks. How does it feel to be a bronze medalist?
It's I actually spoke to Mum about this a couple of days ago. It's so weird now going from looking up to people like Sherelle and Dylan Alcott and Ali Collins, just being like, wow, they're so amazing. It's so cool being able to, like, see them and just be in their presence to all of a sudden now being that person. Because I've had plenty of messages and some Zoom calls of teachers who are just loving me at the moment. And it's a bit different at the moment. Like, it's amazing. Like, all I wanted was that bronze medal. So it's like a gold tick. But it's just so different now knowing that the rest of my life is going to be very different knowing that I'm a Paralympian.
Yeah, and Cole, sorry, I'm looking from afar. I'm at home at the moment in Belfield, which is in Melbourne. I'm not at home in Bermorm. Haven't been there for a while. And it's funny when I hear these boys talking about it as a town. And it just makes me laugh because it's so not a town. But the things that you did when the world did go into lockdown, I'm working from home at the moment, and you had to do the same thing. Came home from Melbourne when you weren't able to train. And tell us about that story, and I know a lot of people will know it, but you actually set the dairy dam up with milk bottles to make a lane rope to make sure that you were swimming straight in that murky water. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, so basically last year in March when the whole country shut down, obviously the rest of the family, I'm in Melbourne for school and swimming commitments. And so when all that shuts down, I'll just go back to the farm. And I think about a week before we shut down, Mum was always sort of like sending messages and photos of like the dairy dam and sort of just making jokes of turning the dam into the pool in case everything shuts down. And obviously, when it did all shut down, we kind of just got home and we didn't really hesitate. We kind of quickly just went, yep, all right, let's get it started. So basically, it's pretty simple, really. So I think the dairy dam, like now it's like 75 metres long. It's about 5 metres deep. But we had this sort of like design it in a way to be diagonal because obviously the Dairy Dam isn't just like a rectangle. It's it's very unorthodox. So what we did was we got some wood crates as like the wall to turn on. To stand those wood crates up, me and my old man hopped in the water and we got these steel fence posts and basically just banged in some steel fence posts into the mud and then just put the wood crates over it. So as like the tumble tent walls or as the wall, whichever you want to call it. And then, as Sherelle just said, for like the lane ropes, we just used some hay string and then some milk bottles to keep it all afloat. So we just messaged all our friends and family in Vermont. It was just like, hey, got any milk bottles or orange juice bottles, etc. Just plastic bottles that could stay afloat. And so we put like millions of them. So they were obviously the lane ropes. And basically, that was pretty much it. I chucked on a wetsuit, goggles and cap, and basically, Bob's your uncle. 3 months later, I did a whole basically autumn in the Dairy Dam. And so it was a very different like style of swimming too. So obviously when you're in a lap pool, you get to keep your head down, you can breathe to the side. But when you're in dirty water and it's 10 degrees, you constantly got to lift your head up. So I went from doing backstroke and butterfly and freestyle in the pool to all of a sudden just doing freestyle and having to stop every wall because I couldn't do that good of underwater because it's all dirty and sometimes I would actually hit the lane rope because I couldn't see where I was going. So it was a very different setup, and in the car fall, we just got our own gym set up. So for that was pretty simple. We went into Bennett's in Echuca. We spent like $1,000 on gym equipment because gym equipment isn't overly that cheap. So $1,000 really isn't that much. And then we just got some more equipment from friends and family, and that was pretty much it. That was the setup for the whole 3 months.
I just love that, Cole, and I love the resilience you've shown just to kind of go, you know, we're going to get it done. I've never swum in a dam. I used to swim in the channel at Bermorm, and that water, you go an inch under and you cannot see anything. So I don't know how you did it, Cole. I guess you had to get a good sense of how you went straight. The other thing that happened, you missed the Australian trials in Adelaide. There were a lot of hurdles that you had to jump over to get there. What was the toughest for you? What was the hardest moment in this lead into to the Paralympics?
So definitely not being able to go to the Australian trials was pretty difficult. But I think probably the main one was all these lockdowns. So obviously being a swimmer, some people like to say it's a very independent sport, but as a professional athlete, and as you guys would know that there's a lot of work that goes into you, not necessarily the work you do, but there's a lot of work that people put into you. And so when we go into lockdown, and obviously the pools are only open for specific athletes, high performance athletes, and training by yourself for 12 months last year, it's pretty difficult to sort of push yourself every day and constantly have that drive to go to training at 4:30 in the morning and then 6:30 at night and 5 hours in the pool. It's mentally and physically draining. So I think really the hardest part was just training through lockdown because it was just me and my coach. And so for 12 months, I had to ride my bike to MSAC, which took about 25 minutes to and from. So not only was I doing 2 hours in the water, I was also doing 50 minutes, basically 50 to an hour bike ride just to and from the pool. So it adds up to like 6 to 7 hour days while still managing year 12. And so that's basically going on from last year and this year. So that's been the really tough part, but there's plenty of others I can rattle off.
Mysac Smith is sanctum worthy, though, from the Geelong Football Club, and he's back in Victoria after the weekend that was for the Cats, and he's on the line. Hello, Mysac.
Morning, Harv. How are you?
Going very well, thank you. How are you, more importantly?
Oh, not too bad. Just readjusting to the Eastern Seaboard time zone, but other than that, going well.
How long does it take for you to readjust?
I'm a shocking sleeper, so it's not quick. It takes a few days, but all good. Can't complain.
Righto. Well, that's good news. What's the routine for you now? Are you currently still required to do things, or are you officially on leave and break now?
It's been a bit funny the last couple of years. I think unofficially we're on leave. We've still got a couple of things to tick off before we fully wrap it all up, but that stuff's done by Zoom and that now anyway. So, officially done, which is very disappointing.
How are you feeling about how it ended? There's obviously been lots talked about from outside the footy club, but how are you feeling about the way it ended on Friday night?
Yeah, it's funny. It's, you know, straight after the game, you're obviously disappointed and annoyed and all those type of emotions. But it's probably, as the week goes longer, the more frustrated and disappointed I'm getting, especially when you start to see all the news and information around the grand final and how spectacular Perth was playing games in front of that crowd and at Optus Stadium. So it would have been an unbelievable grand final to be involved in, but there's not too much to say, really, other than Melbourne were way too good for us and they got the job done. And lucky I didn't pull my house on anything on the weekend, because I would have tipped that we won and I would have tipped that Port Adelaide won. But Bulldogs and Melbourne were just too good, and yeah, it was disappointing.
Isaac, how do you assess the game? Is that something that you take time on in this period of time, or is it just done and dusted, we move on?
I think just with how the world is at the moment, Sherelle, it's awfully difficult. We probably won't all get together now until the start of December, I wouldn't have thought. So due to all the border restrictions and different things, we've got a lot of boys that are from South Australia, Northern Territory, Western Australia, even blokes from Queensland. So as soon as it was done, because we'd done about 3 and a bit weeks of quarantine to that point on Saturday, they've taken off to all different parts of Australia. So yeah, I can't see us getting back together until mid to early December.
All right, well, we might have to have a bit of a talk about it, though, Isaac. When you were going into that game, or even in the early stages of that game, did you have a sense that things were a little bit off, or that they were going to be going down the path that it went down? Because you're right, I think the result surprised a lot of people in the way it happened. When did you realise that that's the way the game was going?
Oh, we still thought going into half time that we were a good chance. We knew that Melbourne had fired their best shot, but a lot of the times in finals, teams sort of fire a shot, and it felt like we'd wrestled back momentum and control of the game leading into half time. But it was probably 5 minutes into the third quarter when Maxi Gorn was kicking goals from 60 out of the ruck that I thought, hey, I know it was probably done and dusted. But in saying that, I think we won the first set of clearance. Joel came out and I thought, oh, we're on here. And Christian Salem intercepted it and they went down the other end. So, yeah, Melbourne, I don't know if they were riding a huge wave of emotion and we didn't rock up or what was going on, but that's one of the white hottest teams I've ever played in the game of football.
Yeah, they're amazing. There's no doubt about that. Is it easier to come to terms with losing a preliminary final when you get beaten easily? And what I mean by that is that it wasn't agonisingly close. It is quite clear that Melbourne were a better team.
No, not necessarily, because I think our best footy, Whitey, was as good as anyone's in the comp, which is really disappointing and hard to come to terms with. And I know some people would say they'd prefer not to lose and miss out on a grand final by a point, but I'd certainly prefer to lose a prelim final by a point than by 80 odds. So, to be honest, I was pretty embarrassed walking off the Oval, and playing that last probably quarter and a half was probably the most embarrassing 45 minutes of football that I'd played in my career, to be honest.
Right, that's pretty strong.
Yeah, well, when you're running around and you know that there's a lot of people watching the game and there's a full stadium and we just didn't deliver, it was pretty disappointing.
So Chris Scott alluded to this after the game, and I must confess, we've spoken about it a bit as well, in that it wasn't just the weekend, it wasn't necessarily even just the first final loss to Port Adelaide. You'd kind of lost your mojo for the last couple of months in the season. Can you kind of put a finger on why that was the case?
Off the top of my head, no. I've certainly got some theories to maybe why it happened, but it's funny. Like, I look at the season and Melbourne came out and they were clearly the best side for the first 10 and 11 weeks of the year, and then they went into a bit of a form slump for 6 or 7 weeks. And got themselves back out of it and produced their best football when it counted. We probably played our best football in the 11, 12 weeks right in the middle of the year.
Yep.
And I think it's just so difficult. And we saw it with Western Bulldogs as well. They went into a bit of a slump, Port Adelaide. And then Brisbane probably slumped towards the end of the year, a little bit like us, which I think this day and age, and especially in the current climate, with everything that's going on, that teams are finding it so difficult to be the best team in the competition for 23 rounds plus then finals. So whether we just didn't time our run right or we had other things go against us, we need to look at it and figure out what happened, because we've still got the list that can certainly have a crack at it. We can't be up there for the whole year and then, you know, just fall off the edge of a cliff, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, tell us about the virus, Isaac. There was obviously a bit of talk about that. How did you escape that, or...?
Well, Sherelle, I was sort of lucky. My end of the hotel didn't get any of it. So, but, yeah, there was a few very crook boys. But in the end, it's funny. I've played some of my best football being sick. So, yeah, it certainly wasn't ideal, and it certainly knocked a few boys for six. But we didn't think that it'd have much of a play on the game. Melbourne were just too good.
And how was the coach after the game? He was in the press conference. He was talking on the lines of, I can't really give too much because just the way of the state I'm in, was paraphrasing what he said at one stage. How was he after the game?
Oh, he was obviously extremely disappointed, like all of us, which was frustrating. But he held himself together and was pretty composed, and just made sure the group, you know, understood what happened, but also we've got to reload and go again. And I think because you're unable to meet for a week or two post the season and go through the things that previously you'd be able to go through, that it was probably a different conversation to what it would normally be.
I don't think Peter Hansom's ever played at Wankdorf Stadium, but he'd just like to be playing at the moment, I'm sure, because the Victorian cricket team's fixture has been thrown into chaos, and he joins us, the skipper of the Shield team. Hello, Pete.
Good morning, guys. And no, haven't had the pleasure of playing out there.
No, I didn't think you would have. But I imagine you would just like to be playing anywhere at the moment. What's the latest? What do you know?
Not a great deal. As you can imagine, it's a very interesting situation. Just trying to find out if we can actually get out of Victoria, trying to find a place to quarantine to be able to get out and play against the other states to get our season started, really.
So you're just in limbo. Is it one of those situations where you just keep rolling on until somebody tells you you're right to go? Is that how it works?
Yeah, pretty much. So we're kind of ready. Well, we are ready to go, but we're sort of waiting on something, waiting on a notice in the next little week to basically just be ready to go within about 5 days and just to get out of the state. So hopefully by the end of the next week, we'll be able to find a place to quarantine and get our season going.
I must confess, Pete, just hearing you say that's like, oh, not again. And that's not someone that's involved. How do you feel about that? That it's sort of history repeating.
In terms of having a quarantine again.
Yeah, and just what it might look like now.
Yeah. It's a shame that, you know, it's another year gone and we're in the same situation as last year. But you know, there's not a lot that we can do, and we're still, you know, we're still very lucky that we've been able to train and play and got our season in last year, and we're going to get our season in this year as well. So pretty much whatever we have to do to get out and play and get this season going, we're happy to do it, and we're ready for it.
Has it been harder, the fact that yourself and Marcus have been over playing in England and it's sort of life close to normal, that you come back to that situation that you find yourself in now here?
Yeah, it is an interesting one, having been over there and sort of seeing where they are in comparison to us, and how they're sort of living with COVID and the restrictions or the rules that they have in place. And then to come back into quite a strict lockdown again was a surprise and a shock to the body. But like I said, we're happy to do anything that we can just to get this season going.
Pete, I was lucky enough to see some of the boys out on the field yesterday having a bit of a... sorry, am I still on?
Yeah, you're still there. We've got you.
I've got issues.
We can hear you, Sherelle. You're all good.
We got you.
That she's, oh, gone. No,
she's gone. She's now. Gone now. She's gone now. I don't know what she's done.
She's fallen off her chair. Well,
She's that flabbergasted by what's happened to the Victoria.
She was so impressed with what she saw yesterday, Pete. Obviously, she's just fallen off her chair.
She's back with us.
Am I here? Am I here, Pete? Sorry about that. Oh, God, the drama's about working from home. Yeah, you were out on the field. What was it like to do that? Because there is going to be some restrictions on how much you're actually going to play before the season gets underway.
Yeah, it was great to get out yesterday. We just played a 40-over intra-squad game out at Junction Oval. So it was just nice for the boys to be able to get some game time into their legs and into their bodies, because the original season we would have started last week, so you know they were primed and ready to go. So it was nice to get out. We've got another one-day game today, and then hopefully next week we can play a three-day game, and that'll get us ready for, you know, hopefully starting the season a few weeks after that.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.